Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
There's evidence that endorphins are really helpful in how the immune system works. So if you're going on holiday and you find that you might have, if you have an autoimmune disease or an allergy or some kind of food intolerance, it might suddenly become a lot better when you go on holiday. And you just attribute that to eating a different kind of food. But it might be because you're happy when you're eating. And it actually boosts these regulatory T cells that we have in our body that sort of gently tap the brakes on the immune system and keep it in check.
Hi, it's Dr. Rupi from The Doctor's Kitchen, and we were going to continue with normal podcast releases this week and over the next few weeks. We've got pods on the ketogenic diet, reversing aging, lifestyle factors for your brain. I mean, a whole bunch of different subjects that I'm really, really excited to get into. However, we thought, what better time than to re-release an episode that we've done with Dr. Jenna Machocki on immune health and what immune health actually means. There's a lot of misinformation out there at the moment, and we thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity to remind people just how incredible our bodies are. If you want some more specific information about SARS-CoV-2, the virus causing COVID-19, then I would direct you to the YouTube Instagram Live that we did. It's available on the Doctor's Kitchen YouTube channel, where we talk about specifically what we know about the virus thus far. It was recorded about a week ago or so, but the information pretty much stays the same at this point. Social distancing, isolation, and trying to minimize any contact is really key right now. In this episode, we talk mainly about what immune health actually means, where it comes from, why it's not as simple as eating to boost your immunity, and what defines a robust immune system. We do talk about foods, lifestyle, and supplementation to support immunity, and what that actually means and how they work, as well as clock genes, sleep hygiene, and why suppressing a fever may or may not be beneficial. It depends on the circumstances. So what I would suggest is relax, take some time out to yourself. We've compressed this episode into one, so it's one long episode, everything to do with immune health. And one of the best things about this episode isn't actually the content, it's just how relaxed Dr. Jenna is. I really love listening to her mellifluous voice. It's just a pleasure, and it was an absolute pleasure to interview her as well. I do want to direct you to something super important, which is her book that just came out. It's called Immunity, the Science of Staying Well, and it is a wonderful resource for anyone looking to understand their immune health in greater detail. And she does talk about a whole bunch of extra subjects that we didn't get time to talk about on the pod as well. So it's things like supplementation, the evidence base behind stress relieving techniques, and what things you can do right now to help you stay well. I think in these current circumstances, it's never been a better opportunity to really focus on yourself and look after oneself as well. So that's the reason why we're re-releasing. That's the reason why I think you should go buy this book, Immunity, the Science of Staying Well. And without further ado, please do listen to my wonderful conversation with Dr. Jenna. And remember, you can find all this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com, as well as signing up for the newsletter, where we give evidence-based recipes every single week, plus all of the lifestyle practices you need, particularly in this pressing time. Myself and my team are working even harder than usual to send you relevant content that will help you through this time. So give us a 5-star review if you find it helpful, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rupi. Thanks for having me.
It's been a while since we've spoken, but we finally got a date in the diary.
Yes, exactly.
And yeah, so I'm really, really excited about this episode.
Yeah, I'm so
I've been following your work for a little while as well.
Thank you.
The first time we met was at my book launch.
Yes, yeah. We have a mutual friend, and I came along. I already had your book at that point.
Oh,
actually,
did you? Okay.
It was nice to come and see you celebrate that moment.
Yeah, and, it was a mutual friend of ours, John Payne, who's a photographer. And I remember him just saying, oh yeah, I brought my mate along. That's cool. And then he told me, you're an immunologist, you're interested in lifestyle medicine. I was like, that's amazing, that's great. And even back then I was like, I think I must have said to you, we should get you on the podcast.
Yeah.
That was back in January 2018.
Gosh, was it that long ago? Yeah.
We're here now.
Finally made it.
So we know a bit about you. We know that your background is in immunology.
Yep.
How did you get into this space where you're interested in diet and lifestyle? Like, do you have a personal story? Like, what's your background?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in rural Scotland. So I grew up on a farm, and I look back and I think, wow, that was a real privilege, because it was very farm to table. And my mum was a professional cook, so she told me everything she knew about cooking. But it was also an area of like a lot of rural poverty. You know, there was a lot of industry closing, a lot of people that didn't have a lot. And I think that what growing up in that environment gave me was knowing how to cook and make something from nothing. And I think that's something that I think's been lost in today's society.
Whereabouts in rural Scotland?
So it's in Ayrshire, in a farm. This is on the west coast.
Oh, I don't know. I haven't ventured west.
Yeah.
I've got to about
it's very
five,
wet.
And I think that's about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's very wet. There's not a lot there.
Yeah.
And we had a really small farm. And
sounds idyllic.
Yeah, it
just
does
imagine
now.
This farm to table food. Your mum's a professional chef. You're living off the land.
Exactly. Yeah. Where, you know, she taught me, because everything's quite seasonal, you know. We didn't have the variety of like exotic fruits and vegetables. It was really like what grew in that season, and you had
to have that. Scotland's got some amazing wild fruits, haven't they?
Yes, yeah, and like mushroom season, you know, we're all over that. Berries that I never see here, like tay berries, they're like these giant raspberries.
Tay berries, have you heard of that?
Yeah, I just grew up thinking I was normal, and then like I came to down south and no one's heard of those. So
I've come across this forager, I think it must have been on a TV program, like a cookery program, where he can mimic different exotic spices from all over the world, like coriander and Thai basil from herbs foraged in Scotland.
I could have looked this guy up.
I'll put it on the show notes, but it is incredible. And that little snippet, I think it must have been on Saturday Kitchen or something, that little snippet really made me think I've got to go to Scotland.
I've really
got to explore the different sort of culinary landscape.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think not always the food is the first thing that springs to mind as being healthy.
Yeah.
We have things like deep fried pizza, you know.
Yeah.
But I think intrinsically, the kind of real traditional diet of Scotland, you can find that it is relatively good for you. And it follows the seasons. And my mum taught me a lot of how to process, you know, when you have all your root vegetables coming at the one time, how do you store that so that they last over winter? And, you know, how to just open your cupboard with hardly anything there and suddenly make a meal from that. And I think those are great tools that people need and perhaps have been lost a little bit.
Definitely. You, like me, had a mother who was really into cooking and you know, food and trying different sort of like types of cuisines as well. And that being instilled generation to generation, I think, is something that is becoming less and less normal.
Exactly. I can't help but think that there's something about the traditional way of life that we've lost. Like, we very much were adapted to our environment because we had to be for survival. And it's kind of like the modern world is great, but have we thrown the bathwater out with the baby?
Yeah.
Or the baby out with the bathwater? You know what I mean?
One
it's like
things.
Some of the elements of how we used to live perhaps might be quite useful now.
Absolutely.
I'm a little bit lost.
I love using that evolutionary perspective.
Yes.
And I think that's going to definitely come into our conversation with immunity today.
Yeah.
But taking that perspective, like, okay, what are we adapted for? And how do we manage the advantages and the benefits of modern living with how we are designed to live, both from a mental and a physical perspective?
Exactly.
As well.
I think when we unlock a lot of the secrets of evolutionary biology, it will yield a lot more in our understanding of why we are the way we are, and then how to self-manage that to fit in with the modern environment, because that's not changing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to go back to our rudimentary way of life anytime
soon. Yeah. I love that. But, So you were based in Scotland, and then you came all the way down.
Yeah, so for some reason, as a child, I had an obsession with health and disease. I was just really curious about it. Maybe it was living on a farm. You see the circle of life, you know. When I was thinking about what to do when I left school, I'd heard about immunology, and there was a course at Glasgow University in the medical school where they just do immunology, and it's very select, it's only 20 students. And I just thought, wow, this sounds really interesting. This sounds like this is the foundation of health and disease. And when I got there, I was like, amazing, I've found my people, this is what I want to do. And that was almost 20 years ago now, so I've just been in the field ever since, and I love it, and I think there's always more to learn.
Your passion definitely comes through on your blog, on your social posts, and some of the articles that you've done as well for major magazines. But let's get into it. So I think, and this is something we were talking about before the show, that the vernacular around immunology is very misunderstood and it's misguiding, I think, for a lot of people, because you'll find lots of articles like, you know, these are the top herbs to boost your immune system and, you know, to kill a cold and all this kind of stuff. So I think we should strip it right back and actually talk about what we mean by immunity.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really, that's probably what got me, you know, talking about this so much in the beginning, just hearing so much misinformation. And I think that the first thing to say that the immune system is this huge complex web that's all over our body. It's found everywhere in the brain and all of your organs and your blood. And people like to think about it as being a single on-off switch. So you want to switch it on, fight infections, you know, create this force field that's going to keep you well, and then switch it off again. And it's actually more like a series of different switches, and you've got to have the right combinations. So it's a bit like a rheostat that you're constantly adjusting to get it just right. But then something in your environment will change, the season changes, and then you have to kind of tweak it again. So it's not just an on-off switch. I think that's probably a hang-up from when people died from infection, and that's maybe going back 100 or so years ago. People might not make it to old age because they would die of infection that we don't see just now. So we're constantly thinking, and we'll switch on our immune system, be invincible to infection. But it doesn't quite work like that. And it's important to say that immunity is what makes us unique. So it's almost like your fingerprint. Even in identical twins, their immune systems will be different. It's the way that the receptors are recombined. There's a really unique way that the genes work to make the sort of repertoire of what we call our immune cells and all the different things that they can sense, so viruses, bacteria. So every one of us is unique. And there's a kind of fundamental reason for that, because, you know, if you think about a room full of people and you throw in a cold virus, if they were all to get sick to the same degree, we'd probably have died out as a species by now. So there's a fundamental reason why we're immunologically all different, because, you know, some people might be more susceptible to bacteria, some of us might be more susceptible to certain viruses or parasites, but if we're all the same, we wouldn't have survived. So there has to be that kind of uniqueness in our immune system.
I love that analogy, actually, because that does tease out a lot about how one thing might work for some person. That could be diet, it could be medications, it could be any sorts of things, and it might not do anything for the other person. And that uniqueness is something that I'm trying to bring out of people as well with the content I put out. It's about becoming the expert of not of health, of not of nutrition, but your own health.
Yes.
And how that relates to you. So there's so much information out there, so much content, but really it's about filtering out that content and deciding, how does that help me in this situation?
Yes, exactly. And I think that's another, brings out another important aspect of the immune system, is that it's always changing. It's not something that we're born with. I like to think of the immune system as something that's made. So you're born with a quite rudimentary immune system, and you're reliant on a lot of what you've got from your mother, both through the placenta and then if you're breastfed. And then your immune system really starts to develop from the moment that you're born, and it continues to develop and change throughout your lifetime into old age. So when people say, oh, I've got a really rubbish immune system, maybe at that moment in time, because you've got a cold and you're feeling lousy, yeah. But, you know, it's not a fixed thing. There's things you can do to change it. And we know that only a fraction of what determines your immune system is in the genes. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is the environment, what you're doing, so things that you can actually be in charge of and manage by yourself. So nutrition being only one of those, but all sorts of lifestyle factors.
Definitely, yeah, and we're definitely going to get into that. So your immune system, essentially this complex set of cells. Mm. I think a lot of people don't realise that anything that really protects you and helps your innate sort of homeostatic mechanisms, your balancing mechanisms, is part of your immunity.
Yes,
so that
exactly.
could be the acid in your stomach. It could be your nasal hairs, your nostril,
exactly.
your mouth, and
secretions on your skin. Exactly. So it's cells, it's molecules, it's those barriers to infection. If you think about where you're normally going to get an infection, it's breathing things in or swallowing things or through the skin. It's the bits that are exposed. And it's not just for infection. I think this is, again, something that people don't think about. It's also the main thing that's involved in repair and adaptation. So if you're going in and working out in the gym, your immune system's helping your muscles adapt, repair and strengthen. It's involved in pregnancy and the success of carrying a child. It's really a key part of the aging process. Mm. It can really determine how well we age. Mm. And it's actually the main cancer surveillance that we have in our body. And I think that's, again, something that not many people think about.
Yeah, I use the analogy in the next book, Eat to Beat Illness, about how your immune system, instead of being an aggressive military force, it's like a peacekeeper.
Yeah.
It's sort of like looking at where there needs to be a little bit more action, a little bit more force, and actually where we need to step back a bit.
Yes,
because an immune system that is overactive, that is boosted, it's not a good thing.
No, exactly.
And that's where we lead to people who are suffering with autoimmune issues, where your immune system essentially loses the capability to recognise friend from foe.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really important. The immune system doesn't just recognise different pathogens, as we call them, so the bugs that are causing infection, but they recognise danger and damage. The immune cells are intimately entwined with all our other systems in the body, so they have receptors for your sex hormones like estrogen, progesterone, so they're affected by different fluctuations in those. Also, they have receptors for stress hormones like cortisol and the neurotransmitters. So if you think about the complete picture, then how you're feeling, your stress, the different hormone times that maybe are going on, for example, in a woman's body, this is all affecting your immune system as well. So it's like the sixth sense, you know, it's really helping us manage our environment.
And
adapt to that.
I think that's a really good analogy, actually, being the sixth sense.
The sixth sense, that's how I like to think about it.
And already, just from that description of just how complicated and intricate the system is, you can understand why just taking a single supplement is unlikely to be the silver bullet that magically improves your immune system to fight off a cold or whatever you're going through at that point in time. So I think that's like already, you know, a good understanding of why these things don't necessarily work.
When I start teaching immunology down at the University of Sussex, the first time that the students get any kind of insight, I show them this huge web of all the cell populations and the subpopulations, and then like the subpopulations, and you can just see, you know, the emoji of like the mind blowing, because they're like, what? There's so many different things going on and so many switches that anything to do with the immune system is going to be multifaceted. So there's going to be a lot of different things going in to give you a certain result. So that's the reason that there's not going to be one single supplement or thing that you can do that's going to give you some kind of immune effect. It's always going to be multi-pronged in your approach.
That description of all those different sort of immunological factors brought back loads of painful memories for me, actually, in medical school, trying to figure out, oh God, like all these different like T regulatory cells and MHC complexes.
Every year they discover a new subset of a subset. Yeah. And then there's like the complement system, which is like,
I actually had some people message me on Instagram and social media just saying, can she describe just describe exactly what a complement is, and what is MHC, what are all these different sort of immunological factors? You know, it's quite funny, actually. There's a lot of medical students, I think, that follow me, and they're just trying to get, like, some answers for their essays.
I always think I've got to work really hard not to scare people off immunology in the beginning, because it does get really interesting later on.
Yeah, yeah. So now we kind of understand what the immune system is. And you're suffering from cold.
I know, ironically. Yeah. Somebody said to me the other day, like, I didn't think you would get sick. You're always talking about the immune system. Surely you should be invincible.
And this is something I talk to patients about. It's like the very fact that you're sick and you have a temperature and you, you know, you have all these other sorts. You have a cough, you have a tickle, you have a throat sensation, shows you that your immune system is actually working.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's about changing your perspective from one that is annoyed by the fact that you have a cold, which is, I get it, it's super annoying, but you should also be grateful and appreciative of the fact that your immune system is working.
Yeah, exactly.
And not everyone has an intact immune system that can tolerate that.
Exactly.
And you're most likely going to be fine in a couple of days.
Yeah, that's the thing. Colds and flus are self-limiting. There's so many different varieties, which is why it's normal to get a few every year. And most of the time, you don't even realize your immune system's working. I mean, we live in this really microbial world, and every day it's just like fending things off. We don't even notice it. And every now and again, one might slip through the net and then you get sick. And the symptoms are actually your immune system more than the actual infection in most cases. So they might be unpleasant, but you just got to ride them out.
Yeah.
And this is again where I think like modern life is hard, because, you know, the general message is like, go down the pharmacy, buy all the over-the-counter medications, and then get to work and struggle through the day.
Yeah.
And if you actually maybe just took a day off or two and rested, you'd probably get over it a lot quicker.
Exactly, yeah. Our producers actually were talking about some cold and flu over-the-counter medications. I was like, oh, what do you reckon about this one? I can't remember what it was. It was some spray for the back of your throat.
It's really funny. Even though I tell this to my husband all the time, he loves himself one of those, like, you know, you put the hot water in and it's like a paracetamol based like decongestant thing. I'm like, that tastes disgusting.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Save your money and
We'll talk about that, actually.
With exactly.
The fever sort of balancing medications and stuff. But now we know how complicated the system is, and it's basically everywhere. Are there any particular sites where the immune system will dominate?
Yes. Well, I think the one that you can't escape is the gut.
It wasn't long until we're going to start talking about the gut.
Yes, exactly. You can't not them talk about the gut when you talk about the immune system. They are completely dependent on each other. And it's that dinner party fact of like, oh, did you know most of your immune system's in the gut? Well, it's true. And there's good reason for that. I think with a lot of things in biology, the form follows the function. So the structure of the digestive tract, the whole architecture, it's optimized for digestion to get the most out of your food. That creates a vulnerability, because it's actually the lining of your digestive tract is only one cell thick. So to me, that's like quite fragile. You know, there's all sorts of things going into your mouth every day. There's just the general bacteria and bugs that are in our environment that we're swallowing. There's things that could be in our food that could make us sick. And just the food itself, how does the immune system know not to respond to that? So because of that, there's maybe about 70 to 80% of your immune cells that line the digestive tract, and they form all these kind of unique structures that have unique ways to keep a surveillance on what's going on. So that's really quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that sort of the very fact that the architecture is only one cell thick shows you why it's so important to have immune cells there.
Exactly.
Because we're in constant communication with our environment via our 30 centimeter long digestive sac, or the first part of it anyway. And that's why, you know, it's just a natural evolution as to why we have immune cells in those areas.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's such a portal for infection, you know, that we have to have those defences there. It's interesting then to talk about the microbiome of the gut. This is getting a lot of airtime. People are getting more aware of the microbiome. And what we do know, that if you do not have a microbiome, then your immune system does not develop. It's completely reliant on the colonization after birth of our microbiome to develop fully. So I think that's another reason why we should take care of our gut microbiome.
It's one of those reasons why we're seeing with C-sections versus natural delivery, and those babies who have C-sections are more at risk of having ATP, so allergic reactions and issues like asthma and eczema and stuff like that.
Definitely.
Not to say that that's a definite it's definite case study that you're definitely going to get asthma, but you're certainly more at risk because of the issues with poor microbial development in the digestive tract.
And there's a lot of work trying to unpick those mechanisms, because I think that's going to be really important to understand. That leads quite nicely on to the point that much of your immunity is actually set up in childhood. So many people who might be thinking, oh, I've got a terrible immune system, perhaps there are elements of what happened in those very early years that have had downstream consequences. And I think it's always helpful to think about what you can affect, and, you know, instead of focusing on, oh, I was a C-section baby, or I wasn't breastfed, or these things, it's, you know, you can't change those. So it's better to think about what we can change.
Exactly. It's a, I have a lot of patients actually in general practice who over the last 20 years of their life, young patients, 20 or 30 years, they had recurrent illnesses as kids. Yeah. And you can almost map a pattern with antibiotic use and C-section and not breastfed and all the other factors beyond just nutrition and medications that may have led to them having issues with their guts or issues with eczema, dry skin, and a whole spectrum of different diseases because of a poor microbial environment. That isn't to say that they are... they're sentenced to that for life, but there are certainly things that we'll end up talking about how we can actually encourage microbial development.
And you might just have a different set point because of those early events that happen, because you're more or less sterile when you're born, and then you're subsequently colonized as soon as you enter into this microbial world. And it's useful to think of it as, you know, the microbes were there before us, so we've evolved with them. We have to find a way to sort of have a mutual relationship. So they actually do quite a lot for us in the gut. They themselves are part of our immune defense. So we talk about the microbial barrier because they outcompete with any bad bacteria that could be coming in through the mouth and not giving them any space. And they also make sure that those that delicate barrier of our gut is really strong and really tight. And this is an area of where I used to actually do a lot of research on when I was in Switzerland, is this whole idea of leaky gut, which I think is one of those kind of woo-woo terms.
It is, But it's weird, because if you type in leaky gut into like PubMed, you won't get much.
No.
But if you type in intestinal hyperpermeability, that's when you get, oh, okay, there is actually a lot of science behind this. Yeah,
exactly. The science has sort of always been there. And I guess the leaky gut term kind of existed in a parallel woo-woo world. And now the two are kind of converging.
So you've actually done some research in this.
Yeah, so that was a lot of the work when I worked out in Switzerland, trying to understand. So I actually worked for a pharmaceutical company. I wasn't making drugs, but they employed me to try and understand what was going on in a normal situation in the gut in terms of the immune system, to try and figure out, okay, what happens when that's perturbed, and then can we intervene with something? So they were kind of hoping that I would give them some drug targets, but I was just like, oh, this is amazing. I can unpick the science. What's going on? And sometimes you have to know what's happening in a normal situation to know how that goes wrong.
And in a normal situation, those tight junctions that exist between these this one cell thick lining,
epithelial cells.
They increase and they decrease, right? And they become more leaky and they become less leaky. But I that's normal.
That's normal. I think that's a really important thing to point out, because people can get very confused if they start doctor Googling leaky gut. But it is a normal for this physiological phenomenon. There's actually certain components of our diet that can exacerbate that leakiness. The two really well known ones are fat, and particularly saturated fat, and the fructose from fruit sugars. But that's not to say that we should avoid those things, because there's actually a lot of evidence that if you're consuming fat or saturated fat or fructose with fiber and with phytonutrients, that is actually fueling the bacteria in your gut, your microbiome, to produce particular things, short-chain fatty acids being one of those, that helps seal up the gut again. So it's actually quite useful to open the gut when you're digesting food to facilitate the whole digestion and getting the nutrients into the body. And then the fiber helps to shut it back up again.
So would you say it's less about having a leaky gut or having a permeability of your gut, and more about the timing of how long you expose those tight junctions to be open, essentially, versus closed.
Yes, I think that's the picture that's starting to emerge, and that I think ties in quite nicely to dietary patterns rather than focusing on specific nutrients. Mm. So how many times a day we're opening up the gut. And one of the reasons that opening the gut up is detrimental for the body is because the microbiome that lives inside our gut can slip through those holes into the bloodstream and all around the body. And while those are considered our good bacteria because they live in the gut and they do a lot of good things for us, when they get in the wrong place, they're just the same as any other bad bacteria. Mm. They have the same molecular patterns on them that send an alarm signal to the immune system. They switch on inflammation. And this can all be happening at a sort of low level that you wouldn't perhaps even be aware of. There are sort of no firm signs and symptoms of this going on, but I think cumulatively over a long period of time, then it could be that we start to see some damage going on and things springing up.
I think it's quite important for the listeners to understand that your immune system is very much related to the inflammation response.
Yes,
and it's essentially mediated by the immune system. So when you need to have a response to a bacterial infection, a virus, or even normal colonization of your gut, it will elicit this inflammatory response. Yeah. And suppose it goes back to this timing. It's like, okay, you can have a little bit of inflammation when you eat because that is very normal.
Yes, yeah.
But when you're eating for long periods of time, so actually when you're grazing or when you're having the wrong sorts of foods and it's this constant sort of exposure, that's when you have this low-grade inflammation.
Yes, exactly.
Termed meta-inflammation in the literature. That can lead to ill health outcomes.
Yes,
and I think inflammation is just another topic that we probably need to spend another podcast talking about.
I mean, I think the one key thing maybe to talk about with regard to inflammation is that it's acute by design. So it's only ever supposed to be a short-term thing. Mm. And then if it's happening all the time, it starts to take its toll on the body. Mm. And we call it chronic, so it's more of a long-term thing. But the leaky gut thing, I think people shouldn't be concerned about. It's normal, but I think that there's things you can do to prevent leaky gut, and fiber and phytonutrients are two of the proven ways that we know help tighten it up again.
I was going to say
it ties in quite nicely with some of the work that's coming out about time restricted eating and consolidating eating into certain times of the day rather than the snacking constantly, because eating is inflammatory. And again, that's normal, but you don't want to be doing it all the time because it's just another load that your body has to deal with.
Absolutely. So when I talk about eating being inflammatory, it just raises a lot of alarm bells. Whenever it's like, eating causes inflammation. Everyone's like, what?
I think everything through like the scientific lens. So to me, it's normal because I know what I mean. But I think when you say it to other people, they're like, it's not that you shouldn't eat, but maybe think about how you're eating. And again, I think it just plays into modern life. Like, it's hard to sit down and have a meal. And everything is rushing. Everything around us tells us to snack. So I lived in Switzerland for a long time, and I came back to the UK 2 years ago, and I was kind of like, everything is prepackaged into little things telling you that you need to eat on the go. And that doesn't really happen in Switzerland. I found it quite a strange observation, like coming back to the UK. And you have to also think about the environmental impact of that, because they're all wrapped in single-use plastic.
Absolutely.
Like, do we need to have so many little snack bars and snack pots and, everything?
I think that's one of the many factors that could potentially explain the French paradox. So everyone looks at the macronutrient combination. Oh, they have loads of saturated fat. They have loads of, meat in their diet. But actually, they spend an hour for lunch.
Yes.
And this whole concept of grab and go sandwiches is just not there. And I think the process of eating and the sense that they get around lunchtime being their time is very telling for why they might have lower rates of cardiovascular disease and
despite having some of the dietary red flags. I really noticed this in Switzerland, which again is a country that has really good health span, and it's a different setup to the UK, so you can't really compare. But I was working for a large company, and they had this huge campus, and at 11:30. The Swiss always started really early, 11:30 every day. They troop down to the different restaurants and stuff on the campus to have lunch, and everybody ate together, and lunch was like one and a half hours, and the canteen was only open between like 11:30 and 1, so you had to eat in that window. And you know, my colleagues were having like a roche thing, which is like the fried potato covered in cheese with a fried egg on top.
Oh my God.
Bacon. There'd always be some dessert or cake, then coffee, but it was like a whole like process. Everybody got away from their desk.
Yeah.
And in the beginning I found this like, I can't eat this for lunch.
Sounds like Christmas lunch.
Yeah,
every
exactly.
day.
But you know, none of my colleagues were very unfit or, you know, looked overweight, or, you know, everybody was very active as well. It's part of the culture and the lifestyle. But yeah. I think it's, yeah, the snacking culture is not served as well. And it's hard to kind of put your finger on what it is about it.
Exactly,
but
yeah.
I'm really convinced that this is not helping us in some sense. And if we can get back to something a bit more traditional, a bit more boring, maybe it's going to be a bit useful.
I think using that evolutionary perspective around time-restricted eating, or as I like to call it, defined periods of eating, it sounds a little bit less intrusive, a little bit less like
restrictive.
Restrictive, exactly.
Yeah.
Some really interesting research coming out from the West Coast of America looking at time-restricted feeding, where you don't change the calorific content of your food at all.
Exactly.
You just change when you eat it.
Yeah.
It's a very actionable tool for a lot of people.
I think so,
and it's
something
that I talked about in my first book, The Doctor's Kitchen, but also in my second book, Eat to Beat Illness, where, you know, that as a principle of healthy eating, just the timing of food, is something that could potentially have very good effects.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're just so over the time of restriction, like adding that restriction onto your life. If you're trying, oh, I'll only have this really low calorie salad that's not going to satisfy me for lunch and leave me just thinking, oh, I want to eat all the food all afternoon. I think that it's not been helpful, and we have to move away from that and start enjoying food. Definitely in terms of the immune system, there's evidence that endorphins are really helpful in how the immune system works. So if you're going on holiday and you find that you might have, if you have an autoimmune disease or an allergy or some kind of food intolerance, it might suddenly become a lot better when you go on holiday. And you just attribute that to eating a different kind of food. But it might be because you're happy when you're eating. And it actually boosts these regulatory T cells that we have in our body that sort of gently tap the brakes on the immune system and keep it in check. So I think there's a lot to be said for, like, you know, how you're feeling when you're eating and what you're doing in your day-to-day life. So
definitely
managing the stress.
Even on an anecdotal level, like, you know, I have patients that come in and they're stressed at work, they're working long hours. Obviously, there's loads of confoundings in the fact that they're probably reducing their sleep, they're probably not eating right.
Yeah.
But certainly stress have an impact on the likelihood of you have suffering a viral illness.
Yeah.
It is certainly there, in my opinion.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah, no, there is evidence to suggest that. I mean, in the short term, actually, stressors are quite useful for the immune system. They clear out a lot of inflammation, and they can actually get rid of a lot of old and aging cells and give space for new cells, because we have this concept in immunology of the immunological space. So you can only have so many immune cells in your body at one time, and as we get older, they start to age. You want to get rid of some of the old ones, bring in some of the new ones. And stresses, like running away from something and or some really short intense exercise or something that is quite stressful but very acute, that can actually be quite beneficial for the immune system. But when it becomes either a chronic long-term stress, so you have to care for a sick relative, or short intermittent stresses, so lots of frequent times when you're becoming stressed, it's maladaptive, so the immune system actually becomes less responsive to that cortisol effect, and you lose the benefits of sort of more acute stresses to the overall health of the immune system.
I've been coming across a lot of research looking at fasting as well as time-restricted eating and its impact on the immune system through the lens of not only autoimmune issues and diabetes in terms of therapeutics, but also cancer as well, which I think, I mean, first, it's, to caveat it, there's very small research studies. It's not practice at the moment. It's not in first-line practice. And obviously, a lot of people who have issues around eating, disordered eating, shouldn't certainly not engage in any fasting practices. Having said that, it is quite interesting from an immunological perspective.
Yes, definitely. I think the research coming out is really exciting, and I'm really curious to see how that evolves. It is very experimental at the moment, but again, fasting is considered another stress on the body, so the immune system is highly dependent on all nutrients. So all the macros, it needs protein, carbohydrates and fats, and all your vitamins and minerals. These are all necessary to help the normal running of the immune system. And they're really good at sensing nutrient status. So they know what's going on and they can respond appropriately. And different nutrient sort of profiles in the body or metabolic profiles can seem to influence the fate of immune cells to go down either more regulatory paths or more inflammatory paths. So it seems to be like manipulating that could help redirect the immune system away from being quite an autoimmune phenotype. So yeah. Help people with that. Also, fasting in itself will kill off any vulnerable immune cells. So as they age, they're more likely to go wrong, like anything with time. You know, as your car gets older, it's more likely to be a bit faulty. And sometimes there is a time where you just, you know, it's
time to change the car.
Time to change, yeah, exactly. Get rid of that. And things like fasting, so reducing nutrient availability makes those kind of older cells a bit more vulnerable. And they're more likely to pop and go through apoptosis, which is this process that removes them. And then you have more space to repopulate with new immune cells.
Yeah. So, I like this because there's lots of arguments for and against it, right? So the process of fasting, upregulating autophagy, which is the self-regulation where you clear out the old dead cells, senescent cells that are sort of like hanging around. They don't really do much. They're not really functioning.
More but
they,
to and go then wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. And they emit like mild inflammation signals and, you know, that can... So clearing that is great. And then also going back to what we were talking about where you essentially give your gut a break.
Yeah.
From digestion, the tight junctions, that can also reduce your immune cell response.
Yep.
But then also, conversely, if you're not eating, then your bacteria are not being provided with a food source.
Yes.
And they could essentially start damaging the lining of your gut.
So
everyone's like, what do I do? Yeah. Do I fast or do I not fast?
Exactly. I think it's finding that sweet spot, and we don't know what that is. So I think the microbiome is a really important point, because your gut is lined with mucus, which is essentially like a kind of carbohydrate source. So if they haven't got any food, eventually they just start eating the mucus, which is part of our defense. It's a barrier. And then once that goes, your gut lining is more vulnerable. But there's definitely a window whereby fasting is having the beneficial effects before it tips over into the more negative effects.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of speculation as to how many hours or days that you should be fasting to give you this sort of reboot. And I think the truth is that we don't know conclusively and we're not able to sort of dish out that to patients or the general public yet. But I think there's a lot of trials and a lot of things are going to come out.
There's a lot of self-experimentation, I'm finding, of researchers themselves who are trying to experiment with fasting. I haven't done it yet myself, but I'd be super interested to see what the effects are, but actually conducted like an experiment. So measuring my vitals before and after and some inflammatory markers and the rest of it. But I think it's going to be really, really hard just looking forward to demonstrate what the sweet spot is for the general population.
It might be quite a unique thing, individual to the person. The age of the person might be quite important as well. So,
And that's before we even think about like the mental health impacts as well.
Declining
yourself to have food when there's so much food around. Yeah. And that could potentially, for certain people, serve to increase your cortisol response, increase your stress around food, and actually lead to an overall negative effect, which is something you have to balance. But that's why I'm just a big fan of the defined eating period.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's something I've been doing for quite a long time now. And I do it with my kids as a practice of getting them used to knowing what a meal is.
Yeah.
That we sit down and we enjoy our food and we talk and it's family time. Rather than being like, oh, you only eat at these times of the day. But they know what breakfast, lunch and dinner is. And gently kind of not put them in a situation where they think it's normal to snack all day. So
yeah, just exactly. Kind
of, and making mealtimes like a happy time.
Because there was this myth, wasn't there? Like, you know, if you graze a little bit throughout the whole day, it'll increase your metabolic energy and then reduce your weight and all the rest of it. But generally what I mean by defined eating periods are anywhere between 10 and 12 hours in the day, where those are the times when you eat.
Yeah.
And everything around that you try and keep clear, obviously within reason. For example, today's Friday. I'm going to go out for dinner with a couple of my friends that I haven't seen for about a month. And we're going to eat.
Wednesday night I had a Christmas party and, you know, I was eating dinner way later than normal because I normally eat with my kids, so it's quite early that they have dinner. But, you know, that's the thing, the beauty of doing everything most of the time, that you've got that buffer for, you know, when you let your hair down.
And yeah.
It was interesting. Recently I was writing an article around this whole hypothesis about the inflammatory load of the gut, and I was trying to find out why we have these guidelines to eat little and often, and this dogma that is really in people's heads that they can't go more than 3 hours because, you know, like something terrible will happen if I don't get food. And I was trying to figure out where that had come from, what it was based on. And most of it was just kind of assuming that we could stabilize insulin levels you know, having the food kind of little and often. And there was no sort of hard, fast evidence on any other reason or why that sort of evolved, and it's just one of those things that people must have thought that seems sensible, and no one ever stopped to think whether that is actually the best guideline.
That's really strange, because actually if you look at some fasting studies, and I think they go back really far, because it's quite unethical to maintain fasting for these patients, but they were going weeks and weeks of just not having any food, and they were maintaining a glucose level, because you essentially go into a state where you start burning your fat, but then when you're running out of fat you're also burning your protein, so you're maintaining a glucose level, because glucose is fundamentally one of the most important fuel sources for all of our cells in the body.
Yeah.
So even if you're not taking in glucose, your body is still adapted to having a glucose level. So this whole process of like eating little and often to maintain a glucose and an insulin level that's low, like doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, if I haven't eaten and I have energy stored on my body just needs to know how to use it, and that's an adaptation, and that, you know, is something that you need to be able to do. And I think we've kind of lost touch with our intuition about eating.
Absolutely.
Something I definitely noticed moving back from Switzerland to the UK, there everything felt quite intuitive. You know, people were eating these huge lunches, and I remember saying to my colleague Sven, like, you know, what do you have for dinner? And he's like, well, you know, in winter I'd have maybe a soup, and then in the summer maybe a salad around like 5-6 o'clock when he got home. But he'd had this huge lunch, and there was nowhere to snack in the whole campus. You know, there was maybe one or two vending machines that you could find somewhere, and you know, that would have food available, but the restaurants and the canteen would just literally open during lunch and then shut again, and it was kind of just like, that's normal because that's lunchtime, and there was not the kind of grazing.
It's definitely not like what it's like here. There's like 10 stores where you can get any sorts of food.
And I just think you have to cut through the noise and think, what are my needs? Do I need all these little plastic pots of snacks all the time? Or, you know, can I wait till lunch and have something substantial that's not going to make me feel like I want to eat again before dinner?
Autoimmunity is a big topic, I feel, these days. Like, what is your impression of why we are seeing increasing rates of autoimmunity across the board? Yeah. I mean, it's not just celiac disease we're talking about. It's not just IBD, but everything that I'm seeing, certainly from an anecdotal frontline NHS point of view, it's just going up and up and up.
Yes.
And there's so many different theories, that, you know, sanitation, the hygiene hypothesis and all these different things. It's probably going to be a combination of a whole bunch of things.
Like whenever I'm teaching at the university, I'm like, nothing in immunology is straightforward. Most questions will be answered, well, it depends. So it's definitely multifactorial. You cannot deny that there is an increase in the prevalence of autoimmune diseases and also allergies, which is just when your immune system is going awry. There's definitely a genetic component to it. In fact, this going back to in the beginning when I mentioned about how we're all genetically very different, there's some genes that predispose you to autoimmunity that actually protect you from things like HIV. So it's really unique. So there's a particular type of compatibility gene that protects from ankylosing spondylitis. So it's quite a horrible autoimmune disease.
Yeah.
And if you have that gene, you've got a really high risk of getting ankylosing spondylitis. It's not sufficient, mm-hmm. but it's a really high risk. But it affects how the HIV virus can proliferate in your T cells, mm-hmm. and it actually makes you highly protected from HIV. So it just goes to show
that's the immune system.
Yeah, it's really cool. You should look it up.
Yeah.
To me, it's just that beauty of the immune system where there's always a compromise. It's like give and take a little bit. So one gene might predispose you to autoimmunity, but it might protect you from something really nasty, which is perhaps why evolutionarily we've held on to it.
Yeah, it's kind of like sickle cell, right?
If
you have the trait of sickle cell, you're protected against malaria because the malaria. If you're affected by malarial virus, then your cell will auto-destruct.
The other kind of interesting thing about autoimmune disease is that almost 80% of them are in women. So I always think that man flu is real, but women get more autoimmune diseases because there's evidence
man flu is real, guys.
Men seem to suffer for longer with infections, whereas women have much more aggressive immune responses, and sometimes that tips over into autoimmunity.
Ah, okay. So boosting your immune system again.
Yeah, it might not actually be. Most of autoimmune diseases seem to spring up in women around the age 20s, 30s, 40s, and it actually your risk seems to decrease after the menopause. So we know that there's something to do with the hormones.
Gotcha.
We know that the immune cells have receptors for both estrogen and progesterone, and also testosterone is involved as well. Testosterone seems to be a little bit immune regulating, which is why men don't seem to have an as aggressive immune response. So they're not as good as fighting off infections as women. But it's a really complicated picture.
I can imagine,
So perhaps regulating your hormones is going to be something that's, you know, going to take care of your body and help with your autoimmune risk. But there's so many theories about...
And actually, this is why, like, the science is complex, but sometimes the solution for some people, and certainly there is some evidence to show, is that the solutions just involve putting your body in the best environment as possible, where you allow your body to operate functionally, optimally. And this is why I'm quite interested in the process of autoimmune protocols and autoimmune diets that are essentially taking out a lot of processed foods, introducing more whole foods. And there are certain ones, you know, there's various shades of grey, right? There's the whole food plant-based diet, there's the whole food paleolithic style diets, there's even a carnivorous diet. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I actually met someone who was doing that the other week. I couldn't keep a straight face.
Okay.
I was like, I'm so curious. Yeah. I want to ask you so many questions.
I know.
They were a yoga teacher, and I was just in the yoga class.
Oh, wow. Kind of a yoga teacher. That's
quite like vocal about only eating meat.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask her so many questions, but I didn't.
I just, you know, from what we know about carbohydrates and fiber and the need for your to feed your microbiota, it just doesn't sound very intuitive.
I was kind of thinking, come back in 30 years of only eating meat and then see how things are.
I can't imagine that's going to be very good.
You know, she was also like, you know, really early 20s. And I think when I was that young, I could do a lot of stuff to my body and it bounced back because I was young enough to deal with it.
Yeah, probably. But saying that, autoimmune protocols have been very effective, specifically with regard to inflammatory bowel disease. So there's lots of evidence or lots of theories as to why that might be the case. There might be some certain food intolerances. There might be some aspects of the microbial population, how it differs with whole food. So
yeah, exactly. That's, for me, I think that's probably one of the biggest impacts that makes a lot of these protocols successful is depending on a dysbiosis in the patient. So there is a lot of evidence that having a dysbiosis in your microbiome can be a trigger for autoimmunity. So I mentioned that there's genetic component, there's a hormonal component, there's various different environmental things that can be all, you're sort of looking to generate the perfect storm of events that are necessary and sufficient to develop an autoimmune disease. And I know that the microbiome is one of those. So if the microbiome's perturbed, this could be due to having an infection or antibiotics, for example, then those bacteria are going to be producing different things. So we're feeding them, they're eating the food we eat, and they're producing, we call them postbiotics. So it's like your own personalized pharmacy of molecules from them eating your food. And if the bacteria are a bit off, or you don't have the right populations in the right proportions, perhaps there's an absence of those metabolites that they're producing, or they're producing different ones, and this is exacerbating an autoimmune disease that you might have. But we're speaking kind of broad strokes, because obviously there's so many different autoimmune diseases, and there's no one single trigger.
Exactly.
It's going to be this kind of perfect storm.
Yeah, it's going to be a mixture of your genomics, your nutrition, and also your lifestyle. And I think that's probably a good way to sort of segue into talking about food.
Yes, exactly.
Because there's so many different topics that we could talk about. Yeah. There's the mitochondrial stuff, there's the hormesis, and I'm fascinated by plant hormetics. I think that it is a very good metaphor for how we are as human beings, this whole constant state of balance.
Yeah.
In fact, actually, you've got a really good definition of hormesis on your website. So I've been reading your blogs. I think it's great. But would you mind talking about what hormesis actually means?
Yeah, so hormesis is a really interesting concept, and I think it plays into that the poison's in the dose, you know. A lot of things are good for us, but it depends on how much we're having. You know, too much of anything is probably going to give us some kind of unpleasant symptoms, whether that's exercise or a particular food and you just eat too much of it.
Water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So hormesis is, this sort of biphasic response where small amounts of something that's quite stressful for the body can actually promote an adaptation to deal with that better, so increasing the resilience, whereas high amounts can just be toxic. And you find that with food in terms of these phytonutrients. So those are things that are part of the plant's defenses, that, you know, they can't run away, so they produce these chemicals when they're damaged or chopped. I know you've had discussions on the pod before.
Yeah, we discussed this with Dr. Anita.
Who's
a colleague of ours, is a gynecologist, and we talked about phytonutrients, in particular turmeric, and sulforaphane, and how these actually exhibit a mild noxious effect to the body, but an overall resilient compensatory response, which is why it leads to benefits.
Yeah.
Which I think is awesome, because there's this whole phenomenon of like introducing ingredients into your body to detox or to reduce inflammation. But actually, what these ingredients are doing is the exact opposite in a small amount, and it's encouraging your body to actually be more resilient.
Yes, exactly. And it's getting rid of these old immune cells that might be going wrong, because they're more susceptible to the stress of these phytonutrients that are exhibiting this kind of hormetic stress on our body. So yeah, I think the interesting thing about phytonutrients is that they're not actually part of our RDA, are they? This recommended daily allowance.
Yeah.
We all know that we should have so much vitamin C, but people don't really know about phytonutrients,
of which there are thousands of them as well, and so it's quite hard to quantify. We haven't really studied them as well as we'd like to.
There's probably one or two that are quite highly studied. You mentioned sulforaphane, which I think is a great example, turmeric or curcumin, which is the active ingredient. But interestingly, they did some studies with them. Turmeric that had the curcumin removed, and they found it still had some of the benefits of the spice. So it shows you it's not just
one thing. And I think we've done the same thing with resveratrol that you find in grape and red wine, and you know, some studies show it does have a benefit, others don't. And it's really about getting back to eating whole as much as possible, because your humble apple will have pectins and it will have quercetin and a whole bunch of other phytochemicals that we probably haven't even discovered yet that leads to ultimate benefits. This is why eating an apple a day, I don't want to spend the rest of we don't need to finish the rest of that line, but you know, it's really important. So going to food and specific ingredients, there isn't actually one specific set of ingredients, really. It's just about eating unfortunately the rainbow.
So I have my kind of key things that I like to focus on, because people would love to ask me, like, how do I boost my immune system?
Yeah.
And it's always things like vitamin C, vitamin E, and of course your immune system needs, as I said before, it needs all of the macronutrients. It needs proteins, fiber, carbohydrates, fats, but it also needs all of the micronutrients, the vitamins and minerals that you know you've we all know about, and you have the recommended daily allowance.
And you'll find
for,
in a general balanced diet, actually.
Yes,
and that's what
exactly.
I find. Most people are hitting the RDA for a lot of things.
Yeah.
But it's the phytonutrients that we don't have an RDA for.
Exactly.
That may lead to the health optimization.
Yeah. And there's little to no evidence for supplementing with vitamins and minerals to, for want of a better word, boost your immune system better than it's already at baseline. Vitamin and mineral supplements protect from diseases of deficiency. Mm-hmm. So if you're deficient, they will protect from that. But I think they've kind of been boosted up to some kind of, you know, gold status where they offer some extra benefits in high amounts. And some of the studies are quite interesting because it actually shows that eating a diet rich in vitamin E, for example, is associated with a lot of health span and health benefits in the long term. But vitamin E supplements at certain doses are actually quite toxic.
Yeah.
So it shows you that the dietary context is really much more useful than a supplement on its own. So there's very little evidence to supplement unless you're plugging specific holes in your diet or you know that you're deficient in things for your vitamins and minerals.
And when you think about what a diet looks like that is high in vitamin C and E, for example, you'll realise, you know, that's dark green leafy vegetables, it's lots of citrus fruit, it's nuts and seeds, which are really good sources of other sorts of minerals like zinc and magnesium. And so it's no wonder that the dietary component is so much more efficient and beneficial than just isolating one particular element of the diet.
Exactly.
And supplementing it.
It's like that multi-pronged approach. There's been numerous attempts to try and put sulforaphane in a capsule.
Yeah, I've seen
it. It's just not really proved very well. I mean, I think there was a guy in the US that works quite a lot on your sulforaphane, and he looked at a lot of the supplements that were out there and tested them. And it's so hard to capture the bioavailability and put it in a pill and have that shelf-stable form that you can take. Opposed to getting it fresh from cruciferous vegetables.
Absolutely.
It's just, there's real problems with like bioavailability. Mm. And there's also been numerous studies of, you know, things like garlic. So garlic's quite known for being a good treatment to, it's got kind of antiviral properties. And so people make garlic supplements. But there's a lot of studies showing that these can be quite toxic because they have to go through the liver. And you don't quite know what dose you should be aiming for when you're randomly buying a supplement, opposed to just putting some garlic in your cooking. I think this is one of the things I love about your cooking is that you make variety from, like, from quite like a minimal amount of things, because you're introducing a lot of herbs and spices and they all contain phytonutrients.
Exactly.
So you're kind of jazzing up real basic staples that you might have in your cupboard and just tipping over the edge to give them that extra bit of nutrition.
Yeah, that extra boost.
Which
and I think
fantastic.
I read one of your blogs, and it's something I've come across before in some studies about crushing garlic and allowing it to steep for about 10 minutes. So it increases the concentration of allicin.
So I think it's these little tips and tricks. Like, there's a reason that we crush garlic. Yeah. You know, it's a lot of it is just, it's intuitive or it's old wives' tales. And I love kind of exploring the science of that and just kind of bringing that to the surface. And things like turmeric, you know, I'm sure if I walk down the street in London I can get myself a turmeric latte. But will that be very bioavailable? Will any of it actually get into my blood? Or if I make a curry tonight and I throw in lots of black pepper, lots of like coconut milk and different spices, that's how you're meant to have turmeric in a meal, and the bioavailability is so much better than, you know, a capsule or a, you know.
Are there any other standout herbs that, alongside ginger, garlic, and onion, that stand out in terms of an immunological sort of?
No, I think it's for me, it's the phytonutrients and it's the fiber. Mm. So the fiber is having that direct effect on the microbiome. They are the ones that are really instructing your immune system to get that right balance.
Yeah.
They're producing this whole cacophony of different nutrients as they digest your food. So you've got to give them the right stuff and they're going to produce the right things. And they can measure them in the blood. Now, I know that there's numerous studies looking at these sort of postbiotics, the things the bacteria are producing. Yeah. And, you know, they're going all over the body and having an effect on it. So I always think it's fiber, it's phytos, and then the right fats. So those are my kind of three things that I'm big on.
What are your favourite types of fats?
So fats, definitely minimizing like the trans fats. We know these are not good for us. I guess I really think about the omega-3, omega-6 ratio and how those work. So I used to work on resolution of inflammation and chronic inflammation. And the omega-3s and omega-6s get incorporated into the cell membranes. And they can hang around for quite a long time. So if you think of what you're consuming in your diet, you know, 3-4 months down the line, that might still be inside your cell membranes.
Yeah,
so it's kind of
that's
always
really
good to have the long-term picture. And omega-6s are important, but they help us, they help our immune cells to really produce those inflammatory responses that help get rid of infections. Mm. And fight the various bugs that are around us. So they are important. And then the omega-3 fats switch to resolution. So inflammation is a cyclic process. We have the firefighting part, and then there's an actual active switch that comes only when you have that first part that promotes resolution. And resolution is active. We tend to kind of forget about resolution. Yeah. It's like that just passively happens at the end of an infection. Mm. But the omega-3s are really important, and they kind of mitigate and offset the omega-6s. But if you have a diet that's quite high in omega-6 fats, the omega-3s don't really get a look in. So you really have to work on boosting the omega-3s and then reducing the omega-6s
and when
to
you
find
actually,
the ratio.
When you concentrate on whole sources of fats and whole foods, really you're going to get that natural ratio, which is either equivalent or 1-4, I believe.
Yes,
which is what we've evolutionarily been adapted to. It's the introduction of dextrose oils, processed foods, poor quality fats, essentially, that put us up in the omega-6, which is still important. Like I'm really glad you point that out, because a lot of people are just very fearful of omega-6, but it's very important for our stress response.
Yeah.
But it's just focusing on whole foods, you'll naturally get that balance.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a really, really important point. So big on the omega-3s, and I think where you get them from is kind of interesting as well. Like fish, and we have to think about the sort of environmental impact of that, and the vegan sources, it's a little bit harder for our body to get those.
Yeah.
So
I recommend algae sources. There's some really good sources of omega-3 in the long chain format, so EPA and DHA, that you can get from algae, but they're a little bit more expensive and less easy to find as well, I find, for certain people. You can get them online these days.
Rather than I feel like over the years, when they've started to focus on particular nutrients and the immune response, we know vitamin C is important. It's not like the magic bullet, but it kind of didn't yield a lot of useful information to focus on individual vitamins or nutrients. And so they started to look at dietary patterns. Uh-huh. And this is where we really see the Mediterranean style diet, lots of antioxidants. And it sort of depends where you live as well. If you have a stressful life in a big city, you're exposed to a lot of pollution, you might have a greater need for antioxidants. And again, food is the best source of these, because if you take too many in a supplement, it can actually be pro-oxidant. So you have to be very careful.
A lot of people don't realise that, about how vitamin C has a pro-oxidant effect.
Yes, exactly.
And that's actually how it may elicit some of its benefits as well. But taken in an isolated format, which is very unnatural in terms of its amount, may lead to some side effects as
exactly.
well.
Exactly, yeah. So the fibre, the phytos, and the good fats.
And the good fats.
Taking care of your microbiome. Yeah. There's some evidence around prebiotics and probiotics, but I think, again, that's kind of muddy waters, because we all have a different starting point. So you can suggest one particular probiotic that's going to help. I think we're not there yet, but that's an emerging field.
Definitely.
There's definitely some evidence of antibiotic use actually making you more susceptible to infection long term.
So
this, I think, is something it's quite topical, because everyone's trying to be a bit more careful with antibiotic use, and it's interesting that using antibiotics might actually end up to you being more susceptible to infection long term. So hopefully that we can steer and start to change that as people are more careful in prescribing those.
This is something I talk to a lot of my patients about, actually, about how unnecessary use of antibiotics, which a lot of people want still, can actually put them in a worse state down the line. What's your opinion on pre and post probiotics during antibiotic use? Do you have a position on that?
There's definitely some studies looking at that, and there's particular strains that they've tried to pinpoint. I just feel like because we're all unique in our diversity, it's kind of, if you want to take a probiotic that might be suggested to be helpful, go for it. Perhaps it's a bit of placebo effect, but I think it's probably worthwhile. I think doing all that you can to preserve your microbiome, so feeding it the right things, having a good pattern of eating, particular soil-based probiotics, so the ones that have a bit more of a shield that help them get down into the large intestine, seem to be more useful. And I think if it's available to you, then it's perhaps useful to do that.
It's a conversation I have very often with patients who come to the emergency department, and I often give some antibiotics, and I talk to them about a few things that anything that nurtures their microbiome will be likely be beneficial for them, if not to protect them against the potential negative impacts of having antibiotics.
Exactly.
So optimizing sleep, reducing your processed and convenience foods and sugar, increasing your whole foods, particularly with a focus on prebiotic fibers, so chicory, artichokes, garlic, onion.
It's not just one type of fiber, is it? You've got so many different bugs in there. I see a lot of prepared foods that have added fiber, and it's only going to be one or two types, and that's not really, I don't think that's a good message to give to people, that they should I've got my fiber for the day. You should really be thinking about different sources.
It's the whole sources and the ones that we probably haven't even discovered yet, because this is an emerging field. And so you're a huge advocate of lifestyle as well as foods and nutrition and stuff, so this is really important from the perspective of immunity as well. So we talked a bit about stress and how that might have a negative impact on immunology or your immune system. Are there any certain practices that you like to talk about yourself?
The reason that I got into kind of looking beyond nutrition was I kind of felt like it was just one leg of the chair. Like, you can have the best diet in the world and everything else is not right, and you're still going to be impacting your immune system. And I think stress is a massive one. So we've mentioned a little bit about that. And then the other areas that I kind of got interested in was sleep and exercise. So exercise is fantastic, I think, for all around for health benefits. But there's something quite unique about the exercise and the immune system in terms of health and longevity. And this is a personal area that I'm really passionate about, because we're living longer, but we're not necessarily living well. Uh-huh. And I personally want to not necessarily live to be 100, but I want to be active and I want to see my family grow up. And so I'm really quite interested in longevity. And I think it was last year or the year before, there was a really fantastic study where they looked at a 70-year-old cyclists, so they're all around 70 and they're in a cycle club, so they're active cyclists, and they compared them to sedentary 20 somethings, and what they found was there's this process that starts to decline in immunity from age 20. So we have the thymus gland, which is located in the neck, and this is responsible for producing the T cells of the immune system, which are like the master controllers. And from around age 20, your thymus gland actually starts to shrink, and we call it thymic involution. So that's quite a scary thought, because you know, from 20, those T cells are just declining. And what they found was, when they were looking at these sedentary 20 somethings and the really active 70 year olds, when you're using your skeletal muscle, like the cyclists were, and you're maintaining a muscle mass into old age, those muscles are producing a very particular molecule, IL-7. So this is actually stimulating the thymus gland and stopping it from shrinking. And they had much better thymus capacity than the sedentary 20-somethings.
That's fascinating. So I'll have to link to that paper in the show notes for sure. But yeah, I'm definitely going to give a read.
Yeah, Professor Janet Lord in Birmingham University. I think one of the professors on the paper was actually the went in the cyclist club.
Oh, really?
A
little bit biased there.
Yeah, exactly,
I wonder where they got the sedentary 20-year-olds from.
But I think movement is so important. So not only maintaining muscle mass, and the muscles are producing something that slowing down the aging of your thymus gland. It's slowing down the decline in our immune system. But movement is activating your lymphatic system. So I think we haven't mentioned the lymphatics yet, but that's the sort of superhighways of the immune system. So it's like a circulatory system, like your blood. But instead of the where the blood is relying on the heart to pump it, the immune system of the lymphatics relies on movement to move it around. And by moving your lymph fluid through the lymphatics, you're distributing the cells to all the different parts of your body so they can perform a kind of surveillance function. So they're going to be moving to the lymph nodes, to the gut, to the lungs. So they're protecting and they're constantly on guard. And so movement, any kind of movement, walking is going to get that going.
Just as you were talking there, I just had this image of like essentially the evolution of man, essentially walking across the plains. We're moving, we're sleeping adequate amounts, we're eating whole natural foods that are minimally processed, and we're also eating within that time period as well, because we probably wouldn't have been eating in the middle of the night either. And that really is a metaphor for how to boost our immune system.
Exactly.
For want of a better word. To essentially improve and support our immune system. Which I think we've pretty much summed up in like a whole bunch of different... We're talking for ages. So we've got this new part of the show where we do rapid fire questions. Excellent. I took a poll from social media, a whole bunch of questions were generated, and we're just going to give you 10 seconds to answer.
Pass.
10 seconds to answer each one. We'll just keep it brief. I know we're probably not going to be able to keep it brief. We'll try and aim for 10 seconds.
We'll try and rein in the tangents.
Okay, fine. This is probably going to be a complicated one to start off with, but should we be aggressively treating fever with over-the-counter medications when we've got a simple viral illness?
Ooh, controversial. No. Let the fever do its thing. If it's going on more than a week, go see your doctor. Fever is productive.
That is really interesting.
Changing tides in the information.
Definitely, because I don't think even a lot of doctors are aware of this information you know, aggressively treating pyrexia. The spiel that I give to a lot of patients, particularly young children who have, you know, very worried parents and they want to aggressively like get rid of any fever whatsoever. Doesn't actually lead to positive outcomes.
No.
But as, you know, we've just learned today about adults, you know, that actually might lead to worse outcomes,
right? Exactly. So reducing the fever might mean you're sick for longer. So, you know, going to the pharmacy, getting all those over-the-counter meds for however much money you spend just so you can struggle through work, it might mean you're just, like, sick for longer. And I think we should respond to the sickness behaviours.
Yeah.
So that's what we call... the effect of these immune mediators when we're sick actually having on the brain and telling us to retreat, go and sleep, go and rest. You might not feel like doing anything and riding out the fever. And that's the quickest way to get well, because most of these colds and flus are self-limiting.
Yeah.
Unless you have an underlying health condition.
Exactly. But, and that's where you need to get help. And you need to, you know, certainly take something from your doctor and be directed by your physician. But certainly I think listening and becoming the expert of your own health, where your brain is telling you, you know what? I need to rest. I need to relax. And
exactly,
definitely. Okay, elderberry, is it worth the hype?
No, I did look into this quite a while ago, and a lot of the studies were funded by the companies that make elderberry the syrup. So it arises suspicion.
Oh, okay.
But I do think anything that's a bit comforting and rich in phytonutrients is going to be useful. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that, but anything, any berries, or, you know, a lot of it's like panacea to make you feel better.
Yes,
you know,
it's not just one
placebo
thing. It's going
effect.
To be. Yeah. Okay, on that note, Jewish penicillin, does that have an effect?
Well, there's something about something that they find in chicken soup.
Just to clarify, Jewish penicillin is a rich broth of chicken soup and veggies. It makes you feel absolutely amazing.
the L-carnosine, which is found particularly in chicken stock, so it's unfortunately not in the vegetarian version, combined with the fact that it's warm and soothing, so it's the steam is helping clear the nose, and it's going to have all those nice vegetables inside. They actually affect your immune cells and what they're doing, so there are studies on that.
That's fantastic. That's good. I actually put medicinal broth as a recipe in my first book, The Doctor's Kitchen.
It's the first thing I go to when I get sick, like my mum's recipe.
That's great. I add like star anise and clove and garlic and all these different things, and it's just, I mean,
and
it
the
tastes
steam
wonderful.
Actually, because the reason we're more prone to viruses in winter is because it's cooler and the air inside our nose is a bit cooler, and they prefer that. So our temperature going up, but also steaming bowl of soup and you're inhaling the steam, it makes it a bit more uncomfortable for the viruses, and it helps your immune cells work a bit better. So
that is a top tip. That is a great, because I'm aware that the rhinovirus at the back of your throat thrives at a low temperature, which is why you see them more in winter.
Yeah, more in winter.
There's
a
whole bunch of different theories out there. It's very interesting. Okay, loads of people are asking about quick ways to boost immunity, but as we've probably gathered, it's not as simple
get
as that.
Get enough sleep most of the time. Eat well most of the time. Sleep well most of the time. And it's normal to get the odd infection. It's, you know, we live in a microbial world. But when it's, you know, more than you might think is normal, maybe go see your doctor.
Is there a way to completely cease a cold if you have one, or do you just have to roll with it?
I think you got to roll with it. I think this cold is a self-limiting infection in normal, healthy adults. And again, tune into what your body is telling you to do. It's probably not telling you to go to work or go to the gym or do any of those things. It's probably making you feel like you don't want to see anyone. You want to lie down and rest and, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So,
is there a role for daily probiotics?
Well, there's all sorts of headlines come out about probiotics. So we don't know if they're working in everyone, because we all have a very different starting point and our microbiome is very different. So if you're throwing in a probiotic, whether your body is actually going to make space for that or not. But we do know that they normally only work during the time you're taking them. They don't often set up residence in the body. So if you're taking something and you feel like it's serving you well,
Then carry on, if it's open to you.
I
think it's really down to the person. And personally, I don't take a probiotic every day, but I do make sure I get a whole bunch of different prebiotics.
Exactly.
Because prebiotics feeding that huge, immense population of trillions of different bugs is probably going to have the biggest effect rather than taking an isolated supplement.
Yeah, when I think about my diet now, I kind of think about eating for my bugs as well. I'm like, you know, what do they want?
I think it's a very good perspective. It's kind of like, what do they want?
Exactly, because our digestion is actually quite basic, and then the bacteria are digesting a lot of it for us and liberating a lot of the nutrients for us. So your diet could be amazing, but your microbiome's not all there because of, you know, past antibiotics or whatever, and you won't be getting the best out of your diet. So it's worth kind of, you know, as a long-term strategy, really trying to nurture that, I think.
Do we have to completely ban sugar to improve our immunity?
Oh, that's a tricky one.
I think
you've got to think about overall dietary pattern. As I mentioned before, we know fructose has quite a dramatic effect on the gut barrier. That's a fruit sugar. But that can be quite easily counteracted with lots of fibre in the diet.
Which you naturally have in a whole piece of fruit.
Yeah, if you're eating fruit. Yeah, so you kind of have to think about how you're eating overall. The active part of the immune system that's fighting infection, so we have sort of the active and the more regulating part, it is very glycolytic, so it loves sugar. It uses that to fight an infection. That's not to say that eating sugar is going to cause that, but when you already have an infection, there is actually some evidence, you know, the old adage of feed a cold, starve a fever. Because a fever is a much more aggressive immune response, they did do some experiments to look at that, and they found that the reason that you might want to not eat when you have a fever is to maybe just tap the brakes on the immune system, because you're just withholding the glucose and maybe that's stopping it being too aggressive and stopping you feeling really, really sick. So, but again, that's, you know, over a really short frame of time.
Yeah.
That, you know, not a long-term thing. So yeah, think about the whole picture.
It's got to be the whole picture. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, I'm
I think it's we run the risk of demonizing one particular macronutrient, and I just think it's quite short-sighted. And you know, sugar is, like we discussed, one of the most important molecules in the body.
Yeah,
with glucose, and there's different monosaccharide forms. So
I also think, you know, it's at this time of year, it's sharing fun times with colleagues and friends and family. And that's tapping into the endorphins, yeah, which is also important for your immune system. If you're stressed about trying to avoid sugar when we're, you know, you're literally walking down the street with Quality Street, yeah, and chocolates and mince pies, then, you know, that stress is not, you know, yeah, you have to sort of look on balance what's exactly important. Yeah.
If somebody is on immunosuppressant medications, yeah, what should they do to support their immune health?
I think definitely find out if you've got any gaps, any deficiencies in any of the key vitamins and minerals. I think vitamin A and vitamin D are quite important for the threshold of the immune system. Again, taking care of the diet, there you might have a little bit more need for things like vitamin C, but it very depends on if you're deficient or not. And one of the best ways actually to avoid infection is good hygiene and,
yeah,
and staying out of places where you know there's going to be infection. People kind of underestimate that, but yeah, that's probably a real key thing to avoid. And movement, so getting the lymphatic flow going, and really good sleep, because sleep really is detrimental to the natural killer cells. These are real viral and fighting cells that we have in the immune system. So
we haven't talked about sleep actually, but there is a question about how sleep impacts immune health.
Yeah, there's massive changes happen when we sleep in our immune system, which is really, really cool. We have quite a lot of inflammatory cytokines go up in the blood, but the cells go down and a lot of new cells are being produced and redistributed, and there's a lot of drainage of all the tissues and the lymphatics. So it's really quite an important restorative time, particularly if you've been sick. Giving yourself time to rest and get that sleep is really important,
which is why I suppose when you get circadian rhythm disruption from travel or from night shift work,
exactly,
and there's loads of questions about night shift workers as why that actually might lead to recurrent infections or a general sort of fatigue and the whole plethora of other things that are happening.
It's really interesting actually when you start to look at circadian rhythms in the immune system. It's like maybe about 80% of the immune system genes are under circadian control, but not all of them. And there's a lot of work to try and unpick what aspects of the immune system are and are not under circadian control and why that might be. So it's definitely emerging. And we know that circadian disruptions leaves you open to infection.
Should I take vitamin D to improve my immunity?
Yes, well, again, vitamins to sort of plug deficiencies. So it is likely if you live somewhere like where we are now in the UK, that in the winter you might get deficient in vitamin D. I think it's worthwhile getting checked. Vitamin D is really important to the immune system, and not in a boosting fashion, but it actually regulates and you know, keeps the brakes on the immune system. So it could be worth supplementing if you think you're deficient. But it works hand in hand with so many other things.
Yeah.
So it needs vitamin K as well, and it needs magnesium. So you kind of make sure you're getting those other factors into your diet. Interestingly, vitamin K is mostly produced by our microbiome.
Yes.
So make sure you're feeding the microbiome.
Exactly,
you can see how it's like a whole cascade of events.
It always comes back down to the microbiome. I remember
I
was meant to be doing my nutritional medicine master's paper, and one of the essay options was vitamin D, and discussing the role for vitamin D supplementation in the UK. And I chose not to answer that because it is so broad, and I already had 1200 words, and it's so broad to go into all the different pleiotropic effects of vitamin D, because it's not a vitamin, it's a hormone.
It's a hormone
and a master regulator of hundreds of different genes, and you're like, you can't even begin to imagine how important this thing is.
The immune cells, most of them have vitamin D receptors on them, so they're directly responding to vitamin
PDRs,
D
and
then it's really changing their behavior and stuff. So if you think you could be deficient, I think it's one that it's very hard to get from diet with vitamin D.
Dr. Jenna, this has been a mammoth session.
I know.
I think it's the longest pod we've had, and we're not even half of the way through of all the different things we should be talking about. We need
to say.
Talk about inflammation in more detail, brain, lymphatics, all those are different things.
We can do a part two.
We'll have do a part three, four, five. Yeah.
Just indulge me, because I could talk about the immune system all day, every day. So.
Good. Well, your passion certainly comes through. It's been
an
absolute pleasure, and we'll catch you another time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Dr. Jenna is brilliant. She is, you know, she's a lecturer. She's holds a PhD from Imperial. She's got a whole bunch of the right credentials, but she also has a gift in that she's able to effortlessly
express the complicated science in simple terms so that people like myself can understand it better. I've been studying medicine for a number of years, and I continue to learn more and more from people like Jenna and other people in this space. Do check her out on socials. She is providing a lot of up-to-date materials, particularly to do with the outbreak, but also generally as well. Check out her book, Immunity, The Science of Staying Well. It's a fantastic resource. I can't recommend it enough. It's brilliant. And it gives a bit more detail and structure to the conversation that we were having today, or when we released it. I think to summarize our conversation, polyphenols are going to be your friend. So trying to get variety and different colors in at every single meal, and the different types of colors represent different phytonutrients and benefits to your overall well-being. So trying to get the purples, reds, greens in is fantastic. Looking after your gut health, and we nurture them with different types of fibers, so chickpeas, lentils, all the store cupboard essentials that hopefully we're going to be consuming more of over the next coming weeks, and think about how that helps you from an immune point of view and an overall well-being point of view. And the other thing are things like nuts, seeds that provide quality fats, along with extra virgin olive oils and all the different cold pressed quality oils that we have that actually have anti-inflammatory effects and can potentially improve your immune health as well. I'd also say things like lifestyle practices. So right now, which is a terribly anxious and anxiety inducing time, it's never been a better time to try and practice gratitude and living in the moment and being present. And I know these sound a bit woo-woo, but actually all it involves is reducing your news and your consumption of media articles, which I agree is very hard to do right now. It's taking moments to focus on your breath, even if it is for about 60 seconds, and trying to try different types of meditation as well, because we know that they can have benefits to not only your anxiety levels, but also your immune health as well. I hope this has been helpful, and we will continue to release podcasts on the normal schedule if we feel it's appropriate. If there's anything new or anything else that you want us to try and cover, we will try and do that as well within reason. But there are lots of resources out there, including the NHS website, the CDC website, and Dr. Jenny Machocki's socials as well. Give us a 5-star review, sign up to the newsletter at thedoctorskitchen.com, and I will see you here next week.